Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Hi, I'm Juliette Selgren, and this is my podcast, The Great Antidote, named for Adam Smith, brought to you by Liberty Fund. To learn more, visit www.adamsmithworks.org. Hi, welcome back. I'm really excited today to be talking to Matthew Continetti. He co-founded the Washington Free Beacon, where he served as editor-in-chief. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he recently wrote a book, The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism, which is what we're going to be talking about today. I think it's a super important conversation to be having. Today is September 9th, 2022. So if that gives any context, I'm sure he thinks it's also very important because he wrote the book. So we'll get into that. Welcome to the podcast first.
Thank you for having me, Juliette. It's great to be here.
So what is the most important thing that people my age or in my generation should know that we don't?
About the right or about the universe?
Just about the universe.
You know, they're somewhat connected, and that is, I think, what people need to recognize is that Ecclesiastes is right. There is nothing new under the sun. Human beings are at root very similar over the long expanse of time and even place. And human nature is, I think, pretty similar over the thousands of years of recorded history. And so you have a lot of similar situations, a lot of precedent in history that needs to be studied. And when you study that, you learn a few things. One, we're not that special, you know, despite what we were told in elementary school. You know, we may be all snowflakes, but we have ancestors who lived through similar experiences, much worse experiences than we've encountered. And two, they got through it. And our generation, your generation, can get through it as well. So I'd say that'd be the most important thing to know about the universe, if I had to tell people in college, is that we've been here before. And the corollary, of course, is study history, study real history, study the recorded history. What happened, and you'll realize that there's a lot that we can draw from.
Humbling, optimistic, and an actionable item. I like it. So before we get started with this history, because that is what this is, and that's why it's so important, I want to unpack some terminology. So Republican, conservative, the right. Yeah. Are these terms interchangeable?
No. That's the other thing you need to know about the right. If I had to tell college students one thing about the right, it's that the right is not monolithic, and conservatism is not Fox News. The right and the Republican Party are not synonymous. So let me give you a few definitions. According to my personal dictionary, the largest group of the three is the right. And this is the continuum of all political persuasions opposed to the left. And the origins of the right go back to the French Revolution in the late 18th century. And kind of the random organization of the assembly in France. And while the left has always pushed for liberation from unchosen, involuntary institutions, and also for maximum egalitarianism, the right has been opposed to the left. And so the way that I use the term is that the right is composed of any group or any individual who opposes the left, who is against the left. But that includes a lot of different people, not all of whom are conservative. So there's a difference between being, say, a radical of the right and being a conservative. There's a difference between being a reactionary and a conservative. A conservative takes the attitude that we should have appreciation for what is given to us. We should have feel gratitude toward our inherited institutions, even those institutions that we join in voluntarily, things that we are born into, like our families or like our communities or the religious tradition we are born into, or our nation that we're born into. We don't choose where we're born. And the conservative says, well, we should appreciate that and we should feel gratitude toward that, those unchosen obligations, but that we should also recognize that the way to keep things the same, the way to preserve those institutions, is to be open to reforming them, open to change, which means that the conservative tends to say, let's go slowly. Let's be humble. Let's recognize how little we know. Let's be sure that we recognize the law of unintended consequences. So that's a conservative. An American conservative is slightly different from that. An American conservative accepts that worldview. But remember, a lot depends on what a conservative is trying to conserve. And an American conservative is trying to conserve the American founding. What makes America special? Well, what makes America special is our founding documents, the principles of the Declaration of Independence, the institutions set up by the Constitution, federalism, checks and balances, rule of law, separation of powers. And what that means is that unlike European conservatives who defended the inherited institutions of, the monarchy or the established church or the hereditary aristocracy, American conservatives defend the established institutions of the Constitution, of republicanism, small r, rule of law, quality before the law, all of these individual rights, individual freedoms that are in the Constitution. That's what the American conservative is meant to defend, in my view. Finally, you have the Republican Party. The Republican Party is a political institution. It's not a philosophy. The Republican Party reflects its membership. The Republican Party has a storied history. It was the party of Abraham Lincoln. It stood for free soil, free men, free labor. It's the party of Calvin Coolidge, the party of Dwight Eisenhower, the party of Ronald Reagan. At the same time, it's the party of Richard Nixon and the party of Pat Buchanan and the party of Donald Trump. The Republican Party is a vehicle. It's a tool shed. And it is a mistake to think that Republicans, just because they belong to that party, are going to be conservative, much less believe in the special mission of American conservatism.
That was a brilliant explanation. And I know I needed that breakdown. And that's a really good context to the book and understanding. It's 100 years, but it's not a movement that is fluid and always unified. I think that often we talk about, okay, oh, the right, the left, the libertarians, this, that, and there's this idea that, oh, well, there's no conflict within. But if the right embodies being against the left, sometimes libertarians fall into that. And obviously, libertarians and conservatives are at odds a lot of the time. And so it's kind of, that was a very good way to a lens to look at this through. And then obviously it's such a big book. There's a lot to unpack. But more specifically, there are different flavors of conservatism and people throw around neocon, tradcon, natcon. What are the distinguishing characteristics of these categories?
Well, there are a lot of categories. Maybe start with the libertarian conservative divide that you mentioned. The conservatism or the right in my story is very libertarian at the outset of my book in the 1920s. The kind of the American right was fully fully behind the idea that the Constitution, limited government, federalism, and the free market were all interconnected. And much of the right's energies were devoted to opposing efforts to increase the size and scope of the federal government in the national economy, in the daily lives of Americans, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And where libertarians and conservatives began to kind of diverge was after the Second World War, when many conservatives still retained that opposition to centralized government in domestic politics. But because of the Cold War and the threat they saw coming from the Soviet Union, believed that the state was necessary in foreign policy, that there ought to be a Pentagon, there ought to be a CIA, that we ought to station troops overseas, that we ought to become involved in conflicts like the war in Korea or the war in Vietnam. That's what really divided the conservatives from the libertarians. The libertarians' anti-statism encompassed all spheres of life, domestic and foreign. And in fact, there are libertarians who believe in personal liberation as well, who believe that really there's no authorities that should be obeyed other than the individual conscience and individual consent. So that's kind of a sketch of where, say, libertarians and American conservatives differ. There are many other groups. You mentioned one other group I can talk a little bit about, and that is the neoconservatives. I think neoconservatism is the most misunderstood phenomenon in American life, and it really saddens me the way that people misunderstand what neoconservatism is. Neoconservatism began in the 1960s and 1970s to describe a very small group of intellectuals who had been part of the left, but because of what they saw as the unintended consequences of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, began moving to the right. And there are about three waves of neoconservative thinker, as I see it. The first was embodied by Irving Kristol, the writer and intellectual, who had been, he had been a Trotskyist when he was in college. He had been a Marxist when he was in college, but kind of abandoned his Marxism after he fought in World War II and became a liberal intellectual. He was a Cold War liberal, which meant that he supported FDR, he supported the New Deal, he supported Harry Truman. But among the things he supported these figures for was their opposition to totalitarianism and to autocracy. So Cold War liberal was liberal in the domestic sphere, that is, supportive of the welfare state, but also an internationalist in foreign policy and willing to intervene overseas to fight communism. So Irving Kristol started as a Trotskyist, became a Cold War liberal, and then in the 1960s, as the left changed, as the left became more egalitarian, as parts of the left kind of began to appease the radicalism on campus and then the anti-war movement and in the Black Power movement, Crystal found himself on the right, and he was the first neoconservative. And then there was another group in the 1970s, kind of led by Norman Podhoretz, who they didn't start out as Marxists. They started out as Democrats, still Cold War liberal Democrats. But after the Democratic Party nominated George McGovern, who was known for his opposition to the Vietnam War, as their presidential candidate in 1972, Democrats around Norman Podhoretz, including other famous intellectuals like, say, the UN ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, began being more and more critical of their party, the Democratic Party, for what they saw as its abandonment of, one, the fight against communism, and two, liberal principles of freedom, for one, and two, individual merit, right? Which they were very much opposed to affirmative action, which really took off in the 1970s. And then, so they kind of joined Crystal and moved toward the conservatives and ended up supporting Ronald Reagan in 1980. So those were the neoconservatives. When you hear the word today, people are thinking of the third wave of neoconservatives, who are the children of these figures I mentioned, and who didn't start off on the left at all. They all started on the right. But the irony is that they're now on the left. So these are figures like Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, Max Boot, who began as Republicans and who very much supported an expansive interventionist foreign policy. But when Donald Trump came along, found that they could not abide him. They could not stand his positions on foreign policy, his positions on immigration, on trade, on race. And more they've ended up being part of the Democratic Party and the Democratic Coalition. So when people hear the word neoconservative today, they're thinking of that third group. And that third group's important and, you know, obviously it should be studied. But I wish more people would recognize that the achievements and accomplishments of the first two groups of neoconservatives, whose thought I think bears study today, because I think it's very relevant to today.
So, big picture, why right now? It deserves study today, but right now, no pun intended. Why should we be looking at the history of conservatism, American conservatism right now?
Sure. Well, there are a few reasons. One is there's really no book like mine. the closest thing to my book is a book called The Conservative Intellectual Movement in America by George Nash, which is a wonderful book. It was George Nash's PhD thesis. It started that way. And it was first edition was published in 1974, and he's updated it in the years since. I think most recently in 2007. The real narrative takes place between 1945 and 1972. Really, that's the bulk of his scholarship in there, and it's much more an intellectual history. It's not really a narrative history or political history. So I thought we needed a book that would just kind of tell the story in the full and round by someone who is an American conservative. I am an American conservative. I grew up, I didn't grow up. I spent the last 20 years of my life. I've spent my adult life, my post-college life working for conservative institutions, beginning with the Weekly Standard, which I joined in 2003. I then left the Weekly Standard at the end of 2011 to found the Washington Free Beacon, which I edited from 2012 to 2019. And in 2019, I left the Free Beacon to join the American Enterprise Institute. So all three are center-right institutions. And I've had contact and friendships and freelance work with many other conservative institutions throughout my career. So I thought that perspective would be useful because so many histories of the right are written by liberals. And so they kind of treat this history with a sense of suspicion from the outset. So I wanted to tell the full story from my perspective, being as detached and fair as I could be. And then the other reason I wrote the book was that beginning in 2012, I just became more and more aware of the estrangement between the conservatives I hung around, my friends, the kind of conservative policy wonk / journalists / intellectual types who live in the Beltway, and the rest of the right throughout the country. And as we were sitting here trying to think through how to approach new situations and paying attention to the power of ideas and trying to preserve the intellectual inheritance of this movement, the right and the rest of the country was taking a very anti-establishment populist turn. They did not like the conservative intellectuals. They thought that we were responsible for everything that had gone wrong. So I wanted to study, well, where did that gap emerge? Where did this great divide begin? And so the book is partly an exploration of that. And what I found, though, is that in truth, the intellectuals were never as much as in control or influential as maybe I had thought or as we had thought. That the right, because as you say, is so multivarious, is so factional, there had always been groups and elements and trends on the right that were opposed to the type of conservatism I believe in. And so I wanted to kind of tell that story as well.
It was interesting to me to learn that most people think, to quote the jacket of the book, when most people think of the history of modern conservatism, they think of Ronald Reagan, end quote. That was never how I thought of it when I grew up. I mean, I was born in 2003. So by the time I was kind of conscious of all of this, I was like, oh, spending, protectionism, this, that. But then as I learned about the intellectual history and what people were thinking about the movement and how they define the movement, it always came back to Ronald Reagan. So then I came to understand how those kind of descriptions existed, because to me, I had never seen that. You argue that it starts, you argue against the notion that it really starts with Ronald Reagan. You talk about the 1920s. So can you kind of lay that out for us and how that started this war?
Mm-hmm. Well, so this relates to a third reason that I wrote the book. So most of the histories of the American right kind of they follow kind of a set chronological pattern. They begin after World War II, and they basically trace the development of post-World War II American conservatism from William F. Buckley Jr. in the National Review to Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater's run for the presidency in 1964, which was a colossal defeat for Republicans and for conservatives, to the apogee, which is in these narratives, Ronald Reagan's election as president in 1980. And then either the narratives in these histories end, or they kind of tail off and they kind of treat everything that has happened since Reagan's election. And I mean, as your age testifies to, and you know, and as mine does to some degree, I mean, I was born in the first year of Reagan's presidency. It's been 40 years, you know, 42 years since Reagan was elected. So there's a lot has happened. So I wanted to kind of show that when you take this longer view, when you try to tell the story of the right, beginning not after the Second World War, but beginning after the First World War, beginning with the election of Warren Harding in 1920, And you carry it to the 2020 election, to, and the book ends with Joe Biden's inauguration in 2021. You see that actually Reagan is a very important figure, important for, you know, the world politics, important for American politics, but in the actual history of the right, is something of an aberration. He's unusual. He's unusual, one, in the constancy of his beliefs. You know, Reagan didn't become a Republican until he was in his 50s. He started out as a Democrat. He started out as one of those Cold War liberals. Then he became a Cold War conservative. But he's also different in his behavior. He was a very unusual form of populist. He was a populist, but it was all positivity. It was all optimism. There was no scapegoating. All of the populist energies were directed against big government, which is this abstraction. It's not a minority group. And he had a very open-ended view of human flourishing and progress. So he wanted openness, choice, growth. That was Ronald Reagan. When you look at the history of the right over the last century, I mean, different figures espouse those things in different places, but a lot of the right is the opposite. A lot of the right is closure, close us off, right? Protect our borders, protect our industries. It is, it's not choice. It's kind of direct authority, right? And it's not necessarily growth, but it's more kind of, it's not quite stagnation. It's either, it's stability. You know, we don't want things to change, right? Not recognizing that conservative insight is that you do need sometimes to change for things to remain the same, as paradoxical as that might sound. So when you look at this century-long history, I found that Reagan is more an exception than he is the rule. And I wanted to communicate that to my readers.
So then, who are the important figures in the evolution of the right? What did they contribute, and how did their ideas influence the direction of the movement? That's a big freaking question.
It's a big freaking question. There are a lot of them. The book is, as you know, you've read it, 450 pages long.
Pick some favorites?
I'll pick some favorites. We've already talked about the neoconservatives.
Yes.
Let me talk a little bit about maybe two other figures who kind of represent two different, a couple of other figures who were in conversation with each other. The first would be Russell Kirk. Russell Kirk was a traditionalist conservative. He was a very interesting and somewhat eccentric man. And his DPhil, which he was writing at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, after the war, after World War II, became a book called The Conservative Mind, which was published in 1953. This is an extremely important book. It's when the right, the mainstream right in America, adopted the label conservative, right? But what's interesting about Kirk's conservatism is that it is not the libertarian conservatism that had predominated in the 1920s and 1930s. It's a traditionalist conservatism. He thought he was the, he called himself a Burkean conservative. And of course, Burke is not an American. He was sympathetic to the American Revolution, but he wasn't an American. And some of the most famous passages of the Reflections on the Revolution in France are defenses of monarchy. But Burke kind of stood for a very traditionalist, almost anti-capitalist, agrarian version of conservatism. And his book was a bestseller. It became a huge hit. And that strain in conservatism has always coexisted with another strain, which we'll talk about Milton Friedman, say. So Milton Friedman was Kirk's opposite in almost every way. You know, Milton Friedman, small Jewish guy, born in New York, raised in New Jersey, goes to Rutgers, then he goes to the University of Chicago, the most brilliant economist of the 20th century, who built up a kind of just this incredible CV of empirical economic work before he really became known for his advocacy of the free market. And his first book is his first popular book, Capitalism and Freedom, is published in 1962. So about 9 years after Kirk's book. And whereas Kirk was for tradition, Friedman was for the market and competition and freedom, liberty. That was his central value, right? And you can see how these two things can kind of clash, right? Especially over questions of the market, questions of dynamism, growth. So those are kind of the two wings of the right. And, you know, even sometimes Friedman would reject the label conservative. He was kind of ambivalent about it. If people called him a conservative, he didn't really care. He preferred to call himself a liberal in the classical liberal sense. Sometimes he called himself a radical for capitalism. And I guess maybe the third figure I'd mention is someone whose legacy is very present in the news today. And that's a man named Harry Jaffa, who was a political philosopher. He was a student of the philosopher Leo Strauss. And in 1957, he publishes a book called Crisis of the House Divided, which is a study of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And for Terry Jaffa, the right needed to, the American right was not worth supporting unless it grounded itself in the principles of the Declaration of Independence, in the idea that all men are created equal, that all human beings have this essential dignity and freedom that is the consequence of that dignity, and responsibility that is a consequence of that freedom. So he found himself attacking or critiquing both traditionalists and libertarians for different reasons. Because he felt it was the most important fact was kind of to appreciate the Americanness of American conservatism. And his legacy lives on today. Some say his legacy has been warped by an institution that was founded by his students in the late 1970s called the Claremont Institute, which is very active in pro-Trump circles. So maybe in addition to the figures that we've already discussed, people like Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, William Kristol, Robert Kagan, people like William F. Buckley Jr., Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, we should also pay special attention to the contributions of figures like Russell Kirk, Milton Friedman, and Harry Jaffa.
And then another big question, what about the important events that have influenced the right? I'm thinking kind of Pearl Harbor, Cold War, 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, sort of an influence have they had?
That's a great question. Well, you mentioned Pearl Harbor. Prior to Pearl Harbor, the American right and indeed the Republican Party was very much anti-intervention. America First, right, started in 1940 to oppose American involvement in World War II. Pearl Harbor happened, the Japanese attack America at Pearl Harbor, and America First closes its doors. America goes into the world. And many of the conservatives who had opposed intervention kind of dropped their objections to it. And by the time we emerge from the war in 1945, we see in 1945, 1946, 1947, that actually the conflict is not really over. Certainly Nazism and Japanese imperialism have been destroyed completely, but our one-time allies, the Soviet Union, has now moved to expand its empire and is now threatening us with nuclear arms. And so the many conservatives who kind of, all things being equal, probably would have returned to their pre-war anti-interventionism say, well, we can't do that now. We have to face down this threat. Communism is atheistic, it's materialistic, and it's totalitarian. There's nothing worse than communism, right? We have to oppose it. And if that requires an interventionist foreign policy, if that requires us to keep standing armies, to have troops deployed all around the world, to have a massive nuclear arsenal, we're going to have to do it because we have to defeat communism. So that was a very important date. I say the fall of Saigon was important as well. It happens in 1975, and it kind of really sets in motion a lot of trends that help end up benefiting conservatives and the Republican Party, mainly because it's kind of a hinge point where a lot of those neoconservatives we talked about begin filling up the ranks of the conservative movement. But also because Americans don't like feeling humiliated. And between the war, the war ending in the way it did in Vietnam in 1975, American troops had been pulled out by then, but the collapse of the government, the images of the evacuation, and that humiliated us. Between 1975 and the Desert One flop, which was the rescue mission that the Carter administration attempted to save the hostages that were being held by the government of the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1980, the spring of 1980, that rescue mission failed. That was another humiliation. I think Americans really just wanted to have a sense of renewed pride in their country and patriotism. And that helped Ronald Reagan in 1980 very much. 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall, hugely important because, well, remember, I just talked about the importance of communism and changing the attitude of the right toward foreign policy. And the Berlin Wall sets in motion a series of events that end in the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Union. We recently just marked the passing of Mikhail Gorbachev, the last dictator of the Soviet Union. And now the right was like, well, what do we do? and American conservatives began splitting. Some thought that America should maintain its dominant position in world affairs, should basically be the guarantor of international security and continue to intervene overseas, continue to deploy our forces overseas, continue to have a massive defense. Others, like the figure Pat Buchanan, who I treat at length in the book, thought that it was time to revive America first. It was time to close all those bases. It was time to come back home. It was time to stop meddling in other countries' affairs. So that debate really begins with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. I'd say, yes, 9/11, of course, it inspires George W. Bush to really side with the thinkers and politicians who want America to remain very engaged in the world, to spread democracy when we can, to stand for human rights when we can, to use military force when we must. But the truth is, that wasn't really like a revolution in thinking. Most Republicans had felt that way since the end of the Cold War. So I would say that the real turning point came with the financial crisis. So I would say September 22nd, 2008, I think, is the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Maybe September 20th, 2008. With those were crazy days. The financial crisis basically delegitimized the Republican leadership in the eyes of Republican voters. The war in Iraq had actually been stabilized because of George W. Bush's late in the game surge of troops and change in strategy. But when the global economy basically teetered on the verge of collapse, And of course, the Great Recession, which accompanied that financial crisis, led to many people losing wealth, losing their homes, losing their jobs. And on top of that, the Republican Party's response, a perhaps necessary response, was to bail out the financial institutions, which were partly responsible for the mess. That resulted in a fissure between the Republican elites and the Republican grassroots, a fissure that has never been healed or sewn up again. So those would be four or five dates, I think, that matter a lot in my story.
And in your book, you make reference to these pillars of American conservatism. How have those, how can you see those throughout this history? And also, how does populism and this shift and like modern day, like past few years, play into that?
Well, I often think of a line from Barry Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which was published in 1960, and which is really the Bible of the conservative movement. And in that opening pages of that book, Goldwater writes that the conscience of a conservative is pricked by anyone who would debase the dignity of the individual human being. So that has been what the conservative movement has been all about, was all about. And that emphasis on individual freedom and individual dignity, individual rights, that is what conservatives thought themselves to be defending and why they love America, because America has allowed for the most individual freedom, the most individual flourishing, protecting that dignity throughout its history. And there's no reason why populists can't agree with that sentiment in Barry Goldwater. But in truth, though, populism is not conservatism. They can overlap. They can be in a coalition together. But populism wants, it's not necessarily weighed down by principle, right? That was a principle I just stated from Barry Goldwater. Populism wants the will of the people to be expressed now. Populism wants leaders to know why the populace is angry and to do something about it. And that this is a kind of a current that runs along conservatism and many populists feel the same way about many issues as conservatives, but sometimes they can come into conflict. And so, to name one example, George Wallace, you know, the governor of Alabama, who's famous for his pro-segregation stance, he begins running these populist presidential campaigns. He's a Democrat, but he begins running as an independent in 1968. Then he kind of goes back into the Democratic Party for some primaries in the 70s. Are classic populism. The elites have screwed you over. Everybody is wrong. There's no difference between the parties. We don't need any of these brainy intellectuals to tell us what we need to do. We just need to get tough, right? And the conservatives at National Review opposed George Wallace. And they opposed him because, look, he was for the welfare state. He did not respect the dignity of the individual human being. And so the National Review folks got into trouble with a lot of their readers who were populists and who kind of liked George Wallace. And it was something similar when Pat Buchanan began running for president in the 1990s. And Buchanan's economic program was protectionist. It was anti-immigration. It was, for industrial policy. And the conservatives said, hold it. You're abandoning the economic dimension of what American conservatism is about. The right today doesn't pay much attention to Barry Goldwater. Right today doesn't pay much attention to Ronald Reagan. It likes Ronald Reagan. It appreciates him. But really, the right today is focused on Donald Trump. And Trump's philosophy is not the same philosophy as expressed in the conscience of a conservative in 1960. It's a populist philosophy, and it's also a personalist philosophy. It's a philosophy that, as Trump said in his convention speech in 2016, only he can fix things. So he's the guy. And if you say a bad word about him, all of a sudden you'll find yourself being called a rhino. It has nothing to do with ideas or policies or principles. It just has to do with, are you going to follow the leader where he takes you?
Do you think that that is going to leave the right away from conservatism? And I guess, I don't know if I want to say, are you optimistic? But what do you want this book to serve as? Is it context? Are there actionable items? What do we take away from this?
Well, I mean, it's a history book. So I want to teach the history. I want people to know where they are entering the story, or to kind of relive elements of the story that they had already experienced. And one fun thing about the reception of the book is I'm often told by readers, oh, I lived through these events, and it's neat to kind of experience them again. You know, and it's mainly readers who are, you know, boomers, baby boomers, and kind of because I, you know, there aren't many people alive who remember the 1920s. So that, I mean, that's why you write a book. You kind of, or this book is to kind of, especially for young people who are interested in the right, I want to be able to give this book to them and say, well, okay, well, why don't you read this book and then come back and tell me what you're interested in? Because so now, so many people now, they only know the right through social media, right? Or podcasts, and maybe Fox News Channel, though I think people your age don't even really watch television. They're on YouTube, you know, and so that's fine. Those are all media. But they don't really communicate the tradition. It's all very present. It's all, what are we doing now? And it's all very, you know, emotional, because that's what attracts audiences. Social media gets attention. I wanted to have something to say, okay, here you look, read this book. Tell me what you think about it, and which thinkers appeal to you, or do none of them appeal to you? In which case, I probably don't have much to say to you. But that's the purpose of the book. Am I optimistic about the future? Well, I think the right needs to rediscover its principles and its history, and needs to be aware that, you know, in my view, Donald Trump may have made a compelling critique of the right and of the Republican Party and conservative elites in 2016. But now I don't see him advancing that critique or really advancing the aims of conservatism all that much. And so I don't know what, I think the right is in a holding pattern for as long as Donald Trump is its leader. And I don't see any signs, I could be wrong, that he's going to stop being its leader anytime soon. So I guess it's just kind of a waiting game, and hoping that people use this time maybe to learn more about the right and maybe appreciate freedom. That's the trend that disturbs me the most. For me, the conservatism is freedom. It's a tradition of liberty in this country. That's what conservatives are meant to defend. And yet more and more, I find young people in particular on the right who don't like freedom at all. I don't know why that is. And I think it's a trend that needs to be fought. So we'll see whether we have any success.
It's really good for me and my generation that you have people telling you that your book is allowing them to relive something, so that's great for me, because that means that I got what I needed out of this and that it's available. So fantastic job. I have one final question for you. What is one thing that you believed at one time in your life that you later changed your position on, and why?
Well, I say, I put it this way. I give a lot of thought about immigration policy to the United States. I tended to be kind of, when I was your age, tended to be kind of the idea that, you know, don't worry about immigration. We're a country of immigrants. Yes, we have many illegal immigrants, but, you know, it will work out eventually. Then I kind of moved to a position where it was much more hawkish on immigration for many years, where I really thought that America needed to clamp down on illegal immigration. In the past couple of years, though, I've become more appreciative of immigration to the United States and the contributions of immigrants, and the fact that, you know, the American assimilation machine still works pretty well. And so I've become more open on immigration than I was, say, 6 years ago. So that I'd say that's probably the issue in which I've changed my mind the most in recent years. I would say maybe on trade, it may have gone in a similar direction as well. But maybe I didn't really change all that much on trade. It's immigration is the primary issue.
Once again, I'd like to thank my guest for their time and insight, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the Great Antidote podcast. The Great Antidote is sound engineered by Rich Goyette. If you have any questions, any guests, or topic recommendations, please feel free to reach out to me at thegreatantidote@gmail.com. Thank you.